Welcome to this week's Big Boat interview with me, Stuart Campbell. For this week's interview, I sat down with Sir Ben Ainslie, the most successful sailor in Olympic history. But it's not the Olympics that's occupying Ben nowadays. It's the twin obsessions of returning the America's Cup to the UK for the first time ever and competing in the third season of Sail GP. We discuss both events, as well as how he copes with the pressures of his job and even the time he was rescued by Sir Richard Branson. Without further ado, here is my interview with Sir Ben Ainslie. Ben, thank you so much for joining the Boat Briefing podcast. It's great that you're with us, especially given that you must be extremely busy at the minute. You're off next week to Chicago to compete in the second race of the third season of Sail GP.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. Good to be with you. Yeah, that's right. We're off to Chicago next week and looking forward to getting back into Sail GP again. And plenty going on. It's busy times.
And obviously, America's Cup's ramping up. Your base has moved to Palma.
Yeah, that's right. We're just about to start testing operations with the America's Cup. Like you say, we're based down in Palma, which we think will be a good venue for testing through the end of the summer and into the winter and next year. And then looking forward to getting up to Barcelona, you know, as and when we get a little bit more clarity on the setup there and when we can, you know, respected teams can get into their bases and the sites there and get a stake in the ground.
And it's fascinating to me the dynamics between the two events. I mean, Sail GP, it feels like is slightly what the world of sailing needed, this kind of regular, codified, one design series, a truly global event that everyone can kind of get behind, based on nationalities too, which I think is really exciting.
I think that's right. I think the sport's been crying out for an event, a global event like Sail GP, with the continuity that we're now racing pretty much month in, month out, and growing that audience, which is so key for the sport. And, you know, the boats are really exciting. The F50s, they're all one design, but there's a lot of technology going into Sail GP to keep developing the boats, the performance, you know, the human machine interface, the tactical apps, and of course the data that's flowing out of the boats, and all of the teams are sharing between themselves and learning from one another. And then that feeds in, of course, to the TV spectacle that the viewers are able to see the course mapped out on the screen, and of course the data coming off the boat. So the whole package, I think the whole product is really growing at an incredible rate. And I think it's something that, like I say, the sport's been crying out for, and we really need it to be a success.
So it's the Formula One, isn't it, really, of world sailing?
Yeah, I think everyone in the league is really proud of ultimately what Larry Ellison and Russell Coutts have put together, and the team behind the league, you know, huge amount of effort gone into it. Of course, the racing on the water and now the commercial partnerships that we're starting to see come together with the likes of Rolex and Mubadala just recently signed up to the league. And NIA, which is a really exciting new blockchain technology business, and many other partners starting to come into the league and to the teams. And then, of course, the Impact League, which is the sustainability-focused league, where all of the teams are racing off against each other to see who can be the most efficient and the most sustainable, and the collaboration that's coming through that. I think it's really exciting.
So I'm going to ask you really what might be a slightly tricky question. Would Sail GP exist if anyone else but New Zealand had won the America's Cup in 2017?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, where we were headed with the America's Cup in 2017 and the partnership or framework agreement that the teams, all of the teams, bar Team New Zealand, had signed up to, I think we would have seen the Cup morph into something like what we have now with Sail GP. Of course, that didn't happen. The one team that didn't sign up to the framework agreement was the Kiwis, who went on to win and take the Cup in a completely different direction, really, in terms of the AC75, the foiling 75-foot monohull. But, you know, maybe that's a good thing. And the Cup does have this special event status, I think, in our sport. It has the history, it has the prestige. And, you know, it's only ever 3, 4, 5 years or you know, whenever the holders decide it's going to be. And really for something to grow in sport, to get that following, as we're now seeing that traction that CLGP is getting, it needs that continuity that we keep talking about. And that was always going to be very, very difficult to achieve in the America's Cup. You know, CLGP is centrally managed by Russell Coutts and the team behind him at the league, and that gives them the freedom to be able to make the right decisions, both for the short term and the long term.
And you always come across as a very calm, considered kind of channeled and, you know,
some
individual.
Some
of the time. But there must have been an element of exasperation and frustration after you and many of the other teams in World Sailing have done, or the America's Cup had done, so much work to get this framework kind of agreed. And then New Zealand runs away with the cup, and of course, it's all torn up.
Yeah, I mean, it was at the time, it was frustrating for everybody involved. I mean, take nothing away from Team New Zealand. They dominated that cup and deserved to win it. Clearly had a different future in mind. And again, that was, you know, for them to decide. I mean, thankfully, again, coming back to Larry and Russell, that they had the determination to see it through and, okay, didn't have the America's Cup logo or credibility, but they've now created through persevering and let's face it, through some pretty tumultuous times with COVID and everything else that the world's been facing the last couple of years, to see that through. And really now we're starting to see that traction that CLGP is getting, and the success we're starting to see both on and off the water. So, you know, credit to them, I think.
And you were one of the first teams to sign up to CLGP. So you were a believer from the get-go.
Yeah, we were the first team ultimately to take ownership of our franchise, our GBR franchise, if you like. So Chris Bake and myself and with Larry Ellison, who has a minority stake in the team, really wanted, saw the potential in the league. And I think as for Chris and myself, as huge fans of the sport, kind of feel like it's incumbent on us to really try and help, support, and make a difference through our own team being a success and the wider league being a success. You know, if any true commercial sporting event in sailing has a chance to be a success, and it's CLGP, and like I say, sort of feel a responsibility to try and help ensure that it is a success. I think it's really important for the future of the sport.
And is there any danger that CLGP will tread on the America's Cup's toes or vice versa?
I mean, that's a question that does come up a lot, understandably. I mean, my view on it is that the two events can and should absolutely complement one another. You know, we talked about the America's Cup. It has this special event status, rather, like the World Cup of sailing or the Olympics it does, in terms of being every 3 or 4 years. CLGP has that continuity that we've said, you know, the sport's been crying out for. And, you know, it may take some careful management, particularly in 2024 with the scheduling of the events. But, you know, I think, you know, we should really be working hard to make sure that that schedule complements one another, and that, you know, long term, that the two events coexistence actually support one another. That's really what I think we should be working towards.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the America's Cup is so magical, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it's in any danger of fizzling out. I mean, I think there will always be a massive amount of interest in any America's Cup event.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's got so much history, prestige, you name it. It's a really iconic event, but there will always be teams, wealthy, successful people that want to have that America's Cup, want to have succeeded at that level. And I guess the quirkiness of it is what's also appealing. Commercially, though, CLGP and the way that CLGP is managed and operated for an annual circuit, again, which we come back to, the sport needs to grow that fan base, that support base. You know, that's where I think CLGP has a huge opportunity. And, you know, we're all really excited about where it's headed.
But it, what about the just in you, that fire that burns to win the America's Cup? I mean, is that as bright as ever? I mean, for a guy with as many gold medals as you to have this massive, the oldest sporting trophy in the world that doesn't yet sit on your mantelpiece. I mean, does that, how much of an inspiration is that and a driver of that for you?
Yeah, I guess it's that goal, you know, we set ourselves back in 2014 on the back of, you know, being involved with the Oracle team and that amazing event we saw in San Francisco with the comeback from 8-1 down. The fact that Britain's never won the America's Cup, that's the goal, that's what sort of drives myself and the rest of the team to get that job done. You know, we set out to achieve that. We've had two campaigns. We haven't quite got there, but I'm determined that we will get there. You know, as long as it takes, we're going to get that job done.
And after the last cup, obviously the COVID affected Auckland event, which was personally gutting because my flights were booked. I was due to be out there. Obviously that all got cancelled, but that was quite a tricky one for you guys, the competitors, because, you know, New Zealand was one of the strictest countries in the world in regards to COVID regulations. So personally, it must have been quite challenging.
Well, look, I think all of us out in New Zealand felt incredibly fortunate at that stage to be where we were. I think it was probably one of the only places in the world that could have held an America's Cup at that time. And also, frankly, to be living in such a beautiful part of the world, relatively unrestricted. You know, there was definitely a sense of feeling rather, what's the right word here? Guilt isn't the right word, but we certainly felt extremely fortunate to be there. And it was such a shame, of course, that people weren't able to come down and enjoy the New Zealand hospitality. You know, the conditions were just fantastic. It would have been, you know, even with the domestic support crowd, there was a huge flotilla out there watching the racing. And of course, that would have been massive with international travelers being allowed into the country. But, you know, it was what we all had to deal with. We were fortunate that the cup went ahead. And now we're looking at a very different cup in Barcelona in 2024, albeit with the same class of boat with some modifications, but a completely different venue. It might well be quite a challenge for all of the teams in Barcelona. People that have sailed in Barcelona know that, you know, you can very often get some seaway coming into Barcelona. So for a foiling, albeit 75-foot foiling monohull, that might provide quite a challenge in certain wind directions. So yeah, we're really looking forward to that. And of course, getting our planning in place now, looking forward to getting into Barcelona next year and setting up camp.
And after Auckland, was it always your intention to become the challenger of record? Had you not won the event, did you think, okay, second best is will become challenger of record and, you know, have some say in the protocol for the next cup?
Yeah, the challenger record piece was something that kind of developed through the event, if I'm honest. I mean, I used to sail for Team New Zealand many years ago. So I got a good relationship with Grant Dalton and the rest of the team there. And I think it became clear that, let's say, the relationship with Luna Rossa wasn't as probably from either side, they would say, as they wanted it to be. And Team New Zealand had to start thinking about should they defend, which they were obviously backing themselves to. You know, where were they going to go? Who were they going to partner with? And it became clear through, you know, my conversations with Jim and Andy and co at INEOS that, you know, they were keen to go again with the cup, regardless of whether we won or we didn't win. They wanted to keep going to get the job done. And therefore, having a relationship with Team New Zealand and being that challenger of record and having an opportunity to help steer the next event where we thought perhaps there were some subtle changes that need to be made, to have that opportunity was something that we were interested in. And that's really how it came about. It all happened quite late in the day.
And after Auckland concluded, and even before the Challenger of Record announcement was made, I think there was a period where the Solent was mooted as a possible location for kind of a match race around the Isle of Wight between you and Team New Zealand. I mean, how far along did those conversations really get?
I have to say they were quite well progressed. I mean, it was we were, there's sort of, I guess, some understandable criticism that was thrown towards ourselves and Team New Zealand. I mean, it was, as we've seen now with Team New Zealand, looking for ways to commercialize the event to help fund the team. And they clearly could see that they were going to struggle with that moving forwards from 2021. So really it was about, you know, how can we help commercialize the event, bring some income in for Team New Zealand, help create, create some continuity in the interest. Going back to this point that we always struggle with the America's Cup, you know, you have a big build up, you have a great event, and nothing happens for 3 or 4 years. So the idea was to help create some more continuity in the event and then move forwards to a more traditional America's Cup, 3 or 4 years down the line. You know, as it transpired, you know, there wasn't, you know, the interest, there wasn't so much interest for a UK event commercially, and it was very much a Team New Zealand driven operation. And so it really didn't live for that long as a plan, if I'm honest. It was something that was mooted early on and then, you know, fizzled away relatively quickly.
And there are a few other locations mentioned in the press in the meantime. Jeddah, I think, was mentioned. And eventually Barcelona was the ultimate destination. I mean, you're pretty happy with that result?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Barcelona, for a neutral, I mean, that has to be one of the perfect venues anywhere in the world, doesn't it? It's an incredible sailing venue, great iconic city, hosted the Olympics in 92, of course, and many, many other major sporting and cultural events. Yeah, compared with some of the other options on the table, I think all of the teams were hugely relieved with Barcelona. I think it's a great result for everybody.
I think so, yeah. Certainly for audiences, it makes a lot more commercial sense than, say, Auckland, which is a bit tricky for everyone except the locals to take part in, live anyway. And when you look at the AC monohull, the foiling monohull, and the F50s that you race in the Sail GP series, I mean, is one edgier than the other? I mean, which gives you more sleepless nights?
probably the F50 gives you more sleepless nights because of the nature we're racing it with, fleet racing, obviously, and it's, you know, the performance is actually remarkably similar, given the differences in scale between the boats. But the F50, you know, there's now 10 boats on the start line. You know, we're all arriving at Mark 1 at a similar time. And, you know, the boats are obviously more open with the cockpit layout, the fact that it's a multi-hull, of course. And I think that it's a lighter boat, so it has more of a feel of a dinghy about it. It's more responsive, I guess, and the acceleration is much higher. The AC75 feels much more solid, particularly upwind. The performance is phenomenal upwind in the AC75, and you know, it's a very different boat to sail. You, for the nature of the racing and the layout of the boat on the AC75, you feel it's more solid. It's you feel, I guess, more secure in a way than on the F50. F50, like I say, is much more responsive and a lot, it's a lot of fun to sail.
And I remember, I've interviewed some GC32 sailors, and they said, this is it. This is the ultimate kind of edgiest seat, thrill ride kind of fleet sailing. But I suppose the F50 takes that on to the next level still. I mean, is there a way to possibly describe the feeling of foiling at 50 knots, tacking in and out of other boats, rounding a mark? I mean, that is edge of the seat stuff.
Yeah, the F50 is seriously cool to sail. And I remember we were sailing in Sydney Harbour, and it was a, you know, traditional northeasterly sea breeze blowing about 20 knots. And a good friend of mine actually came on the, well, you know, Chris Cecil Wright, who's one of the leading yacht brokers in the world. And he was out in Sydney and came on the back of the boat. And I said to Chris, remember this is the best bit of sailing you're probably ever going to do in your life, because you have to pinch yourself. You know, you're going along at sort of close to 50 knots and the boat's just, you know, on fire. And then you've got Sydney Opera House in the background and the Harbour Bridge. And it's just phenomenal. It really is. And to think back, you know, oh, for me now, thinking back sort of 30 odd years to learning to sail in Optimus and then progressing into lasers, to think that we would be sailing at the speeds we are now, racing these kind of craft, is really mind-blowing. And it's great for the sport. It really is great for the sport that it's developed so much in the last 10 years with the F50s and now the AC75s in the Cup. So many more opportunities for the sport, and I think for attracting and inspiring youngsters, most importantly, to excite them to get into the sport. I think that's fantastic.
And there was a few headlines not so long ago about the GB team and some what was described as reckless driving out on the race course. I mean, how fair was that criticism? And isn't that slightly the point of the F50 and the fleet racing?
Yeah, I did have to chuckle a bit, because I think the person who might have made the reckless comment was the same person that only about 12 months previously had driven into the US team on poor tack, even though they'd seen them coming for quite a while longer. So I think people probably got to be a little bit careful about tossing rocks around. But anyway, regardless of that, yeah, it was a really unfortunate incident. And ultimately, we just didn't see the other boat at all until basically we landed on top of them. And yeah, I mean, it is going to happen when you've got so many boats on one start line and the speeds that they're going. We're obviously working really hard at the league to try and mitigate against that, try and find better ways to get more vision, to get more alerts of boats coming in and out. Obviously, to try and ultimately, there are going to be collisions to try and save, ensure the safety of the crew. So maybe there's some changes to the layout of the boats, for example, and the structural integrity of the boats that we can improve to, again, increase that protection for the crew. So, yeah, a lot of thoughts going into that. And it is, you know, when you're racing that tide, we want to see the action. We want to see the boats getting close. Unfortunately, that's going to happen from time to time.
And if we switch back to the AC75s quickly for a sec. So in Barcelona in 2024, I did see a story the other day that you were looking at borrowing the Cyclor concept. Is there any truth to that story?
Well, the Cyclors, they were outlawed in the last Cup, but they're not outlawed anymore. And we saw, obviously, the Kiwis use it to great advantage in 2017. Given the power requirements for these boats, you'd have to expect that pretty much all of the teams will go down that route for 2024. I'd be really surprised if there's a team that doesn't.
I mean, that's just for everyone listening. That is just the legs generating a lot more power on the grinders than upper bodies, basically. So you're just building hydraulic pressure much quicker. Is that as simple as that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You got it. So it's a power output that the athletes can lay down, and it's measured in watts. And watts per kilo, effectively. And like you say, you can generate so much more of your legs and your arms. And kind of seems obvious now. In 2017, a lot of the teams looked at it, including ourselves, and decided that the practicalities of trying to get on and off a bike and cross a boat and the benefits of the extra power wasn't worth that risk reward. The Kiwis obviously decided it was worth that risk and went for it and gained the benefits of the extra power and how they could control the boat and they could push the boat that much harder. And wasn't the only thing that won in the Cup, but it was a major contributor. So, yeah, that's, again, one of the fascinating areas where the technology is developing in the sport and moving forwards.
How soon in the 2017 campaign did you know the Kiwis were going with Cyclors instead of traditional grinders?
There was a lot of sort of debate within the Cup between the teams. We all had reconnaissance teams out there monitoring each other and obviously monitoring the New Zealanders. We had a reasonably good idea quite a way out that they were going to try it. As I said, we had looked at it, but wrongly discounted it, as it turns out. And then, you know, became clear as they started sailing their race boat and their race foils, you know, the foils were very aggressive. The way they sailed the boat was very aggressive and required, you know, required, like I say, that extra power to be able to control the boat and to control the speed of the foils to get that ultimate foiling angle, if you like. And that whole package was, you know, hugely effective and dominated.
Because there's a long history of spying in the America's Cup. I know there are new rules about it now, aren't there? So you can't be quite as, I mean, it's sending scuba divers under other people's boats and things like that, or spying on people from space. I remember one story along those lines. But I mean, it's a bit more sedate nowadays, is it? Or is there still some subterfuge?
No. Well, I think there's some great stories, like you say, of submarines and divers and all sorts. But now, interestingly, we've brought in a new rule. So each team effectively has its own reconnaissance team that they communicate with. We'll let them know when we're training a couple of days out so that the reconnaissance team can be with us. They're very close to the boat, and at the end of a training session, they'll undertake a number of interviews with key designers and sailors and feed that back into a central reconnaissance pool, if you like, which will then get fed up to the America's Cup website. So for not only the teams, but also the sort of diehard America's Cup fans, they'll be able to keep right up to speed with the development of all of the teams. And we think that will be an exciting initiative to, like I say, get those fans really engrossed in what's going on in the Cup, and also reduce the budgets for reconnaissance for the teams, which are not insignificant when you think you've got potentially six teams now. If we get another team, which we think we will, and you've got to send out reconnaissance teams to monitor all of them, then it starts getting, you know, the bill for that starts getting quite hefty. So, I think it'll be interesting to see how this new rule works out. We're obviously hopeful that it will be a success. And again, it will also help those America's Cup fans get a better insight into what's going on.
When you're not flying above the waves at 50 knots, do you ever do any more slow sailing? I mean, is there a gentle 7-8 knots in a lovely old classic boat? Because you used to own a lovely André Hoek boat, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I grew up in the West Country near Falmouth, and my parents had a small cruising boat. So that's kind of how I got into sailing, was messing around at 5 or 6 knots, you know, sailing across the Isles of Scilly or, you know, other harbours in the West Country, and just love that side of the sport. Like you say, I had a really beautiful André Hoek classic sloop, which I absolutely adored. Unfortunately, I didn't have anywhere near enough time to sail her, and then met my wife Georgie, and now we have two wonderful young kids. So unfortunately, not really the time for, you know, outside of the day job of getting out on the water so much. But that's definitely something, you know, as hopefully time allows, I'm very keen to get back into having a boat and enjoying just being on the water for the beauty of it, rather than necessarily trying to, you know, race around at 50 odd knots, avoiding all these other boats and you know, the intense side of the sport.
And while I've got you, I thought I'd love to hear your side of the story too, because Georgie wrote a column, your wife wrote a column for us once about an incident with the boat when you were supposedly rescued by Richard Branson off Necker Island. So I'd love to hear your side of that story.
Yeah, okay. Well, no, I mean, it's kind of mostly true, unfortunately, that we did have we were on this beautiful yacht, this you know, classic boats, as we all know, classic boats, things go wrong on classic boats. And we had a problem with the mainsail furling unit, where basically the rod at the base of the furling unit broke whilst the main was half in, half out, and was kind of stuck there. So clearly needed a bit of help to sort that out. And I called a mate on the main island, Tortola. And next thing, a couple of ribs turned up. One was from the Costa Smeralda Yacht Club, and the one was from Necker Island. And I think Georgie took one look at the hot-looking young men in the surfing shorts on the Necker Island, from the Necker Island crew, and decided those are the boys that were going to help us out. And so we eventually got the boat sorted out, and then we were sort of drowning our sorrows in the in a bar at the Bitter End Yacht Club. And the next thing, Richard phoned up and had heard about this sort of little incident and invited us over for dinner, which then turned into us staying for a couple of nights, which actually at the end of our honeymoon, it was a really great way to cap that off. And we met a few friends that we had no idea were actually out and on Necker and had a wonderful time. Unfortunately, the boat was a bit sorry, but we patched her up and got her home. So it was, it was a fun story.
Made for some great headlines.
Yes, yeah. Slightly exaggerated headlines, but hey, you know, for a couple of nights on Necker Island, I think we could live with it.
Yeah, not a bad compensation. You mentioned your kids. So you've got two young kids. Everything ramping up again, you know, travel's gone mad, America's Cup pressures. I mean, how is it impossible? Because I travel a lot, but you're next level. So how do you maintain that kind of work-life balance?
Yeah, good question. Well, I have a very, very understanding wife who supports everything that we're doing, thankfully, and a lot of careful planning and a lot of support, really. You know, I'm really fortunate with the America's Cup team. We have a guy called Dave Ending who's our COO for the team. So he and I effectively run the team, and he does an incredible job being able to operate that and make sure we're sort of hitting our targets and deadlines with the Cup team. And similarly with the CLGP team, we have a great team there that are helping to run and operate that. So it really wouldn't happen without that and having the right people around to manage and support things. And then, yeah, careful planning with the dates and just, you know, around the two teams. Whenever I have a spare moment, I'm at home with Georgie and the kids trying to be a dad and trying to, you know, be part of the family and make sure everyone's happy and kids are happy and safe and we're all heading in the right direction. Much like pretty much every other family, I think. Just, you know, like you say, a bit of travel thrown in there.
Is Bellatrix sailing yet?
Not really. We've got a house on the Isle of Wight, and we're very proud members of the Seaview Yacht Club there or sailing club there. And we have what they call a Seaview One Design dinghy, which for those that don't know is a little sort of 10-foot clinker built scow kind of thing. And it's a beautiful little boat. And I've taken Bellatrix out once or twice in that. But actually, the moment she really seemed to sort of, I guess, get excited about it was we were in Antigua a while back, and I took her out of the Hopi Cat, and she just absolutely loved that, loved the speed of the thing. And you know, she's only 5 years old, but she suddenly demanded that she should be steering this boat. And then I think they had an RS Cat, which is a slightly bigger, faster version of the Hobie Cat that we were sailing. So then the next step was to go in the RS Cat, and it was quite fresh. There's quite a bit of breeze, and we were hooning around on this thing, and she just absolutely loved it. So that was a good sign. So we'll try and get her out a bit more this summer, and who knows? But you know, again, like every other parent, you're just trying to find something that your kids enjoy, and you don't really want to push them into too much at this stage. Just make sure they're having fun and hopefully having plenty of opportunities to learn new skills.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's quite a legacy to live up to on the sailing front, certainly.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But yeah, like I said, I think just finding something that your kids enjoy and you know, gets them out and about, meeting new friends and learning how to work with a team and all those sort of great life skills that I think sailing as a sport can teach us. So who knows? We'll see how it goes. But yeah, we're lucky that we've got some good opportunities to get on the water.
So say if you cast your mind forward to 2024 and you win the America's Cup, I mean, is that the last big box to be ticked for you? Can you envision a time where you take a start back seat, or is the desire to drive the boat yourself, skipper that team, does that burn as strongly as ever?
Look, I mean, we really want to win in 24. I mean, that's a huge target for all of us and team. You know, the way, you know, I'm really, you know, proud of what we sort of managed to build with the America's Cup team and with the CLGP team And we've got some great people in there now helping to drive those teams forwards. And my role in many ways is to oversee that and help that development. So, yeah, who knows, at some point, I'm going to have to face up to the fact I'm not always going to be on the boat. But I still, very much see an important role in driving the team and the business forwards. And there's one other sort of challenge, I guess, in the sport that I've always sort of had my eye on and had massive respect for the teams that have been successful in that arena, which is the Jules Verne trophy, which, is the non-stop round the world, anything goes effectively. I think that's an incredible challenge and record to chase after. So who knows, maybe if we could tick off the America's Cup box, then that might be in the final challenge. Let's see. Let's get the America's Cup done first.
Have you run that one past Georgie and the kids?
Yeah, I have actually. And I think Georgie, she can understand that challenge. As a non-sailor, around the world, anything goes. It's a bit easier to understand that one. And she thinks it's great. So let's see.
There you go. Endorsement. It's happening.
Yeah. Endorsement from the boss. So we're on.
Next week you're off to Chicago. And where do you go after that with Sail GP?
Yeah, so we've got Chicago. And then after that, we're back to the UK, Plymouth. So looking forward to that, sailing in front of a home crowd. It should be great. And then Copenhagen, Saint-Tropez, Cadiz. And then after that, in the autumn, we're in Asia. We've got Singapore that was just announced, Dubai, and then Australasia with a couple of other events there. And then the final in San Francisco next March. So, yeah, pretty full-on packed-out schedule with SailGP. And great to see it getting to some pretty serious venues around the world. And like I say, continuing in that growth.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. So it was a fourth last year in season two. You came second in Bermuda in the first race of season three. Did I get that right?
And so, yes, that's right.
So things are looking, the trajectory is up, which is fantastic.
Yeah, we made a bit of a mess, to be fair, of season two. I think you alluded to a couple of collisions earlier in the interview. And, I think we kind of got our risk reward slightly wrong. We certainly, I think, had the capability to sail the boat really well and fast and race well. And so the goal now is just to do everything we can to ensure that we make it into the final three, which is what it's all about in SailGP. You just need to be in that final sail-off for the winner takes all. And that's what we're going for.
Well, best of luck. We'll be watching. And if anyone wants to learn more about SailGP, I really encourage you to tune in. Go to the website and have a look. It's a brilliant series. It's really exciting. Get involved.
All right. Thanks a lot, Stuart. Great to catch up.
Ben, thank you so much. Hopefully speak soon.
Thank you for listening to this week's Big Boat interview, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.